Welcome back, all, to another installment of In Summation, The Final Word. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend. This show is going to be a little bit different, and I think it's going to work out really well. First off, I'm bringing on a co-host who I think you're really going to enjoy. I do some legal commentary for the Law and Crime Network, and occasionally I co-host that program with a man named Joseph Scott Morgan. He's a forensic death investigator. Basically, he's an expert at crime scene, autopsy, blood spatter, and the intersection of science and medicine with the legal system. He brings a really fascinating perspective, and he looks at these topics from a completely different angle. We're going to discuss a case that we've both had the opportunity to comment on while it was ongoing. I'm going to run through some of the background here to give you an understanding of just how we arrived at this trial, and the relevant timeline of this particular case spans around 40 years. Our 78-year-old subject for this episode was just recently sentenced to life without the possibility of parole in California. This is the state of California versus Robert Durst. Robert Durst was born on April 12, 1943, to Seymour and Bernice Durst in Scarsdale, New York. Scarsdale is an affluent northern suburb of New York City. Durst has three siblings, Douglas, Tommy, and Wendy. Durst was born into serious money. His grandfather, Joseph Durst, emigrated to America from Austria-Hungary at around the turn of the 20th century. He arrived here as a tailor, but became a wildly successful real estate developer and manager. Robert Durst's father, Seymour, continued and grew the business to where the Durst organization owns and manages well over $8 billion in assets. Robert, or Bob Durst, never really had any interest in running the organization. His mother passed away when he was 7 years old, when she fell off the family roof. Durst and his brother Douglas had an intense rivalry growing up, and this seems to have exacerbated things. Durst himself, from the time his mother passed away, was socially awkward, and that continued through high school, where he was considered a bit of a loner. In 1965, Durst graduated from Lehigh University in Pennsylvania with a degree in economics, and subsequently enrolled in UCLA's graduate school. While there, he met a woman named Susan Berman. He and Berman became very close, and their friendship remained strong even after Durst dropped out of school and returned to New York in 1969. The rift between Durst and his family, particularly Douglas, was widening, however, and shortly after Durst returned home, he moved to Vermont to open a health food store. In 1971, he met a woman named Kathy McCormick, who was a dental hygienist at the time. On April 12, 1973, Bob Durst's 30th birthday, the two were married. They moved back to Manhattan as Seymour Durst had begun pressuring Bob Durst to take up his presumed role in the Durst organization. And so over the next 8 years or so, Durst's marriage had its ups and downs, and while he internally disdained the Durst organization, he dutifully showed up to work. But in January of 1982, Durst's life begins to veer off the rails. Kathy was now a medical student at Albert Einstein Medical School in the Bronx. She was in her last semester, intending to become a pediatrician. On the night of January 31st, 1982, Durst and Kathy fought, which was not unusual. Durst claims that he last saw Kathy at the Katona Metro North Station, where she got on a train and headed back to Manhattan. Kathy Durst was never seen again. For nearly 40 years, her family has been seeking answers. Durst was extensively questioned, especially since he didn't file a missing persons report for Kathy for several days. Law enforcement found that a bit suspicious. Durst told police that he believed Kathy had simply abandoned him and run off. He based this on the fact that after her disappearance, there was allegedly a phone call placed to the dean of her medical school claiming, by Kathy, that she was feeling ill and would be missing class. This phone call would later become very important, so keep it in mind. Durst would also claim that on February 4th, he received a call from the school indicating that Kathy had called in sick and would be out the entire week. 8 years after Kathy's disappearance, Durst legally divorced her, claiming abandonment. Kathy's body has never been found, nor has anyone had a confirmed sighting of her since the last time she parted ways with Durst. But this episode isn't about the trial of Robert Durst for the murder of his wife in the early 1980s. This is about the trial of Robert Durst for the murder of Susan Berman in 2000. As previously noted, Berman and Durst had become friends before Durst even met Kathy. Berman was the son of David Berman, a Las Vegas gangster. He passed away when she was 12 while undergoing heart surgery. Berman did inherit a little over $4 million from her father's organized crime interests. She used that to get her journalism degree from UCLA, where she met Bob Durst. She was a novelist and wrote memoirs. Friends and family described Berman as a fiercely loyal person, saying she inherited that from her mafia roots. When Berman became friends with Durst, most people who knew her agreed that if she felt it was necessary, she would help him get away with murder. Many of those same people believe it's quite possible that it was Susan Berman who made the phone call to Kathy's medical school, telling them she would be sick, at Durst's request. Susan Berman was found murdered, execution style, in her Los Angeles home on Christmas Eve, 2000. Prior to her death, she'd been having some money issues and had been getting payments from Durst. At the time of her death, the Beverly Hills Police Department received an envelope which had Berman's address and the word cadaver written on it. Beverly was spelled wrong, and the handwriting was particularly distinct. Durst was in Northern California the night before Berman's body was discovered. At the time he was trying to lay low, approximately a month earlier, his sister Wendy had tipped him off that the Westchester County District Attorney had agreed to requests by Kathy's family to reopen the investigation into her disappearance. It's strongly hinted that Durst believed they were seeking to arrange an interview with Berman, who supplied an affidavit in support of Durst back in 1982. So it's not really hard to see why Durst would become a person of interest in the death of Susan Berman. He was documented as being in the state. Law enforcement believed she knew the details of Kathy's murder, and he was giving her significant sums of money, perhaps to keep her quiet. There's a lot of circumstantial reasons to be suspicious here. And before I bring on Joe Morgan to talk about Susan Berman's trial, or the trial for the death of Susan Berman, because Durst is ultimately arrested for the murder of Susan Berman, there are a few more wild twists and turns that you should know about for background purposes. After Berman is killed, Durst goes on the run, as far off the grid as he can get himself. He ends up in Galveston, Texas, where, side note, I lived for many years during my childhood. He's dressing as a woman and pretending to be mute to avoid being recognized. He moves next door to a man named Morris Black. Morris Black's dismembered body was found in pieces floating in Galveston Bay. By pieces, I mean it had been dismembered, although the head was never found. Durst was arrested and put on trial for murdering his neighbor. He hired defense attorney Dick DeGuerin and claimed self-defense. DeGuerin argued that Black had discovered who Durst was, confronted him with a pistol, a struggle ensued, and the gun accidentally went off, striking Black in the head and killing him. Durst then admitted to chopping the body into pieces and throwing the pieces in the bay. It was difficult to tell whether Durst's version of events was actually true, again, because Black's head was never actually recovered. But in 2003, a Galveston jury concluded that this was self-defense. I was no longer living in Galveston at the time, just so we're all clear. But keep in mind that during the duration of this episode, the Morris Black killing took place subsequent to when Susan Berman died. After the self-defense acquittal verdict, Durst is still not arrested for the murder of Berman or his wife Kathy. He served a moderate jail sentence for dismembering Black's corpse, but was then released. Things remained relatively dormant until 2015. You may recall there was a six-part HBO docuseries by director Andrew Jarecki called The Jinx, which featured lengthy interviews of Durst, along with all the circumstantial evidence around Berman's death. Durst had been strongly cautioned against sitting for the interviews, but he did so anyway. The culmination of the series featured a hot mic that Durst wore into a bathroom, allegedly not realizing that it was still recording. He looks into a mirror and says, quote, "There it is. You're caught. You're right, of course. But you can't imagine. Arrest him? I don't know what's in the house. Oh, I want this. What a disaster." He was right. I was wrong. And the burping. I'm having difficulty with the question. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. End quote. The same day the final episode was actually broadcast on HBO, the FBI arrested Durst in New Orleans, Louisiana, nearly 15 full years after Berman's murder. Immediately, the prosecutor on the case, John Lewin, flew out to New Orleans to speak to him. Durst, who again retained Dick DeGaron, ultimately agreed to sit for a three-hour interview with Lewin and an investigator without his lawyer present. During the interview, Durst commits to several positions which could rightly be thought of as contradictory to his stance at trial. So let's get into the discussion of the trial. All right, I am joined here by my co-host for this episode, Joseph Scott Morgan. And I described him as a forensic death examiner, but I'm going to go ahead and let him give you an explanation of what it is exactly that he does and how he does it. So, Joe, the floor is yours.
Well, first off, thank you, Paul, for having me, and greetings to all of your listeners. My background is kind of interesting, I guess, because I work in a field that not many people know about relative to forensics, and that's in what's referred to as the medical legal world. And I inhabit this weird little space. There's not that many of us that are out there. And if people, particularly because I know that your listeners are truly love law and learning about law, it's analogous to the way police officers are kind of the eyes and ears of the prosecutor in the field. We are the eyes and ears of the forensic pathologist, medical examiner, or coroner in the field. And we come at things from a completely different perspective than, say, a death investigator that is a law enforcement officer. At the end of the day, I could care less if anybody is prosecuted. That's not my cup of tea. It's not what I do. What I actually do is go out and assess the scene, assess bodies, the environment that the bodies are found in, and then bring that information back in to the ME's offices, or, you know, my colleagues that work in the coroner's offices. We determine manner of death. The people will think of a gigantic umbrella. And, you know, umbrellas have those little spines that deploy and turn it into, as the British say, a bumper chute. Each one of those little spines is represented by an individual manner of death. So you've got homicide, suicide, accidental, undetermined, and natural. And then the next part of that is cause of death. And so the causes of death are virtually limitless. So you will take the causes of death and you can place them beneath any number of those spines. You begin to think about, like, gunshot wound is a cause of death. you know, that can fit under suicide. It can be a homicide. It can be an accidental death. It can be undetermined many times. We haven't found a mechanism to get it into that natural category yet, but, you know, there it's variable that way. And then our third mandate is the identity of the dead. And a substrate of that is notification of next of kin. So there's a couple of things working here that people might not understand because kind of our jobs in media and entertainment have been hijacked a little bit. First off, forensic pathologists do not go into the field, except on rare occasions. And trust me, you don't want them in the field. You don't want them going through a crime scene because they're not used to it. They're clinicians that work with the dead, that dissect the dead, and or prosect, as it's referred to with humans. And they make an assessment. Now, they will make an appearance every now and then, particularly if you've got a highly complex case. A forensic path might come out there, and certainly in their fellowship, that fellowship part of their training, they will make an appearance as students. I worked in Atlanta for a long time, and we had a fellowship program in association with Emory University School of Medicine. We had two slots per year. It's a one-year fellowship, and one went to generally somebody from the United States, and the other one went to international. There's not that many of these slots out there. Pathology, forensic pathology, is literally the only one of the few jobs in medicine where the more certifications you receive, the less money you get paid, if you can imagine that. So you go through the trial of being a pathology resident for 5 years now, and that's clinical and anatomical, where you work in a hospital and you look at tumors and amputated limbs and placentas and all kinds of manner of things. And you run the laboratory where they do testing on blood and whatnot. You run the blood bank. And then you decide, you know what I want to do? Instead of doing this, you're already isolated as a physician in that construct. You say, you know what I want to do now? I want to go examine dead bodies, maggot-infested bodies, decomposed bodies, skeletal remains, and I want to spend all of my time doing testimony. So when you're not in the morgue, you're testifying.
That's great. So I brought you on because you and I have had the opportunity on a number of occasions to discuss the Robert Durst trial. Mm-hmm. And I know that you share my sentiment that this trial was a real spectacle. And there was a lot going on that was kind of out of the ordinary. And that really kind of began with even the nature of the charge itself. So Robert Durst is arrested for the murder of Susan Berman. But in California, there are what are called special circumstances that can apply. And so the special circumstance that was applied to the Durst case is that the murder of Susan Berman was committed essentially in order to prevent the victim from being a witness to the crime. And so what that allows the prosecution, in this case, John Lewin, to do is to go in a little bit to what the other crime is that the victim would have been potentially testifying about. So, you know, you and I have discussed that in this trial, the first 6 weeks of the trial were devoted specifically to this other crime, the murder of Kathy Durst. Durst's wife, who disappeared back in 1982. And so I wanted to ask you, there's obviously a rule against using propensity evidence in a trial. And what happens is when you have a situation where there's a legally permissible reason to bring in evidence of past potential bad acts that a person has done, you know, to what extent do you think that John Lewin should have been able to establish this other potential crime that Berman could have been a witness for? And did, in your opinion, did the judge allow too much about it? Was it the right amount? Do you think Lewin should have been able to talk about more? Because he really went into excruciating detail about the circumstances of Kathy Durst's disappearance.
Yeah, he did. And I think the watchword here is latitude. I've never you know, I've been appearing on Law and Crime Network with you and others for quite some time now, you know, covering a lot of trials. And I don't recall, I've certainly never been personally involved in a case as a practitioner where I've seen this much latitude given in a court of law. And so it was shocking to the senses, I think. And there's a beautiful term in law that I love that you guys use, and it's corpus delicti. And it's you know, I think for your purposes, you talk about the body of the crime. Well, corpus delicti for people like me is the body of the victim. It is that thing that is that tangible element. I mean, it's what drives us, right? I mean, as medical legal death investigators, that's our stock in trade, if you will. Those base elements that make us up as humans, you know, that define, you know, let's think about the purest sense of how we define homicide. Well, homicide simply defined is death at the hand of another. If we're in logic class in undergraduate in philosophy, the question I would pose is how can we prosecute or how can we state that there is, in fact, been a homicide committed when there is no body to show, when there is no corpus delicti? You know, and Kathy Durst, they went to great lengths back in 82. I say great lengths. We got to contextualize that. They went to some lengths in order to try to track her down and find her. Now, there was some evidence that Durst had put his hands on her. I think that there was one specific time where it was noted and she was treated for having been smacked around quite a bit. You know, she had insults or injuries to her face and these sorts of things. And there was this underlying threat, but that does not make a case for a homicide. So when you begin to talk about this and you're bringing this up from a forensic standpoint, I think the question would be, if they're asking me, you know, what do you make of this so-called homicide? I'd say, I'll tell you when you get a body, and then I'll give you my assessment. I'll tell you what I think about that piece of evidence. But in Kathy Durst's case, you have no corpus delicti, ergo you have no case if it is completely dependent upon that physical corpse. And there's no evidence to that fact. So I was, as the British say, I was gobsmacked over that. And it irritated me to a great degree, I think. And that came through in my commentary. I was blown away because I couldn't believe that we were talking about this case. The guy's got a missing wife at this point. She's still missing, and it's a tragedy, and I hate it. But what else you got? I mean, is this all you have? Is this really all you have at this point in time? They put together timelines and all these sorts of things, but still you can't, a body was never manifested. Okay. And that's what I have a problem with. And I think that anybody that truly loves the law, that's the measure of it. Yeah. You know, how can you manifest this without the substantive evidence?
Yeah. I'm largely in complete agreement with that. I found it very troubling that the judge, Mark Windham, allowed Lewin to go into a lot of the different areas with regard to Kathy Durst that he did. There was a lot of really objectionable evidence regarding that particular aspect of this trial. I found a lot of hearsay and a lot of other immoral acts that kind of pointed at what happened to Kathy Durst that I thought were not in the scope of the special circumstance. I understand that Lewin, the deputy DA who was prosecuting the case, really wanted to be able to bring Kathy Durst into the case. And so he charged that special circumstance. And therefore, I think some leeway should have been given. But I agree, it's incredibly difficult to establish that a murder even took place if you don't have a body. And the idea that he was given 6 weeks worth of latitude to bring in all manner of different witnesses to testify about things that were and weren't done back in 1982 to kind of more or less to throw the Westchester County investigators under the bus for not having done a good enough job at finding Kathy Durst back then. I thought that was really above and beyond what a prosecutor should have been allowed to bring in, even taking into account the special circumstance. And in keeping with that, I want to move to another topic of what I thought was a very strange amount of latitude, to use the word that you used, given to the prosecutor. And that concerns the entirety of the discussion of the Morris Black case. A number of weeks were devoted discussing Robert Durst's participation in the homicide of Morris Black. And for me, the reason that I found this particularly offensive as a defense attorney was that that Morris Black is killed after Susan Berman. So literally nothing about that case has an impact on the death of Berman. There's no way that Susan Berman could have been a witness in that case. The special circumstance does not apply. It cannot logically apply. And on top of that, Robert Durst was acquitted of the murder of Morris Black.
Yes, he was.
There's no question that he caused the death, but it was not a murder, according to the jury in Galveston, Texas in 2003. So for me, the idea that the DA, John Lewin, was able to go into the intense amount of detail, graphic detail. There were photographs. Yes. There were slides. It was really grotesque because, you know, remember, Morris Black was dismembered. So that was an ugly scene. And the amount that the judge allowed to go into this, I felt was nothing but prejudicial and inflammatory.
I'm so glad to use that word. I'm so glad to use that word, Paul. I swear. If you didn't say prejudicial, I was going to say it. So folks at home understand, one of the things that happens in pretrial, if you're the evidence guy, okay, you're bringing forth evidence that is to be presented. And one of the things that they talk about, you know, you lawyers, you know, you get up there, if you're a defense attorney, you're saying, okay, now look, this has already been represented in an earlier photograph. Why do we have to keep going back and back and back to this? And at least in my mind, as an investigator, what I'm hearing you say, and please correct me, is this has been presented. We don't need to go any further. And certainly if we're able, we, the medical legal community, are able to take one photograph and demonstrate some type of specific trauma, an angle, or all of the trajectory, whatever it is, saw marks, those sorts of things, it should be sufficient to have one photograph.
Right.
But what's amazing about this, the fact that they're showing the scene, the fact that they're showing his dismembered remains in these bags, and they're talking about how he facilitated it, went into great detail. Do you remember the interview in New Orleans, mm-hmm. my hometown,
yep.
Where he actually says, well, you know, I can't do his voice. Well, if you're going to do this, I talked to a surgeon, you know, and you want to pull it apart like a piece of chicken. That's there before the jury. That's being stated. And then you illustrate these images that you're seeing. These people on jury, I would imagine that they've never seen anything like this. How many of us actually have? I'm a weirdo because it's what I do for a living. But for me, Paul, when I heard all of this, I'm thinking, okay, I don't doubt that this guy is probably the personification of evil. But this has been adjudicated. This case has been adjudicated, and it was adjudicated in Texas. It has nothing to do with California. So from a practitioner standpoint, if it were me and I'm asking these questions, I would say, if you're the prosecutor, you're going to do this, do you have so little information, so little data that you can bring forth? Your case is so very thin that you got to drag these in here? What's at the end of the day, what is it about it? Because I kept hearing all of you guys that are attorneys, again, non-attorney, I'm sitting here, but I can hear you guys, I can almost hear your thoughts, and you're saying, this is going to be appealed. It just, you guys just kept going on and on about everything that would pop up. It's going to go into appeal. And I'm fascinated by that. Now, I'd like to ask you that question. Do you think that this is a grounds for appeal with this prejudicial evidence?
Absolutely. I mean, there are certain double jeopardy implications that come here. And yes, he is not technically on trial for the Morris Black murder, but certainly the extensive use of that case, which has been adjudicated and adjudicated largely in Robert Durst's favor. He was acquitted of that murder. Right. The affirmative defense of self-defense resonated with that jury. Yep. And Dick DeGaren, who is his defense attorney, both in the Morris Black case and in the Susan Berman case, you know, was incredibly successful in conveying, you know, his narrative of how that struggle went down, how everything happened, and the jury found that he was not guilty. And yet here we are, you know, in 2021, and we're watching, you know, we're watching Dick DeGaren and his co-counsel, David Chesanoff, recreating in a dramatic reenactment in the courtroom, in front of the jury, the struggle between Robert Durst and Morris Black, which has nothing to do with how Susan Berman is killed. And yet the jury, Dick DeGaren is so forced to relitigate this entire trial, which he's already litigated and won, that he has to basically go back and reprove that Robert Durst did not murder Morris Black, because the judge, again, has given John Lewin the latitude to basically, more or less, without explicitly saying it, make the allegation that Robert Durst murdered Morris Black and got away with it. And ladies and gentlemen, don't let him get away with this one. I mean, that is, without a doubt, the message that the jury is being given. And in doing so, you know, they're being grossed out. They are being shown all manner of really horrible things. And as I'm sitting there watching it, all I can think of is, this is 100% an appeal point. And I think this is a very strong appeal point, because one, Morris Black's name should never have even been mentioned in this trial, much less weeks spent dissecting how he died, whether or not it was actually murder, what the remains looked like. You know, the autopsy report was basically just read word for word for the jury. I mean, it was outrageously inappropriate, and I fully expect that to be an appellate point.
You know, another major waste of time for me, Paul, was the I think the guy is a hydrologist at Texas A&M. They bring this guy on the stand. He's a faculty member. I'm sure this guy is bright when it comes to hydrology and tidal flow and all this stuff that is outside of my depth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's talking about the rising of the tides there in Galveston Bay and how this impacts. And that turned out to be a total farce. So I'm thinking, you're wasting everybody's time with this. And granted, I'm a science guy. I enjoyed listening to him. That's not the purpose of this, because, and that can be said throughout, because there was a lot of salaciousness with this case. It almost felt like we were watching part two on HBO.
Yeah.
That's what it came down to, you know, that we were watching this thing being thrown out there. And then you bring in this element. Now, I don't know if you were going to speak to this or not, but I have to mention this, that was, again, highly prejudicial. They bring in a dramatic movie that's based on, the Kathy Durst case. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who, was it Ryan Gosling? I think I've never seen the movie. Have you ever in your life seen them actually seen a court where they allow a dramatic movie to be played from beginning to end? And I could not, I didn't understand what I was seeing here. It was the circus of the absurd, almost, it was.
It really was. And to answer your question, no, I have never had a judge who I thought would even consider allowing the airing of a Hollywood production that was supposed to be about a certain incident that the case was about. I mean, I have certainly had trials that were worthy of such things. You know, during the El Chapo trial, I mean, there were countless, you know, series that have been done about him. Yep. You know, Narcos Mexico is basically the story of his life. But the prosecutors never even thought, I guarantee, about trying to play a Netflix series during the trial. And the idea that the judge in California allowed this fictional dramatic recreation, he just let everything in.
He did. And to that point, Paul, I think, you know, it would be akin to say, if I was testifying in a trial, they say, well, okay, I tell you what, we're going to have a forensic guy. We're going to have this guy come in and give you testimony. This is what you're about to hear. And as a follow-up, guys, we're going to watch a couple of episodes of Dexter. It diminishes the sanctity, if you will, of the court. It diminishes everybody that's involved in it that, you know, that has been going to testify for years and years as experts. And, you know, there's a time and a place for entertainment. When our founders, you know, established, you know, kind of the framework for the Constitution and how all these things operate, this is not what they had in mind. You know, entertainment is there to make commentary about what goes on in the real world. It's not. It's you can't flip that around. And so we entered in, I think, in this trial, unlike anything else, we kind of entered into the Twilight Zone. But, you know, isn't that interesting? Because the whole thing kind of kicked off and was initiated by a docu-crime series on television. That was what forced this thing forward.
Yeah. And I think it's a really fascinating point. And again, this is something that we see from Robert Durst over and over again. It appears at least, and I'm not in Robert Durst's head. I don't know exactly what he's thinking. But to me, it appears that he is always confident that he is just the smartest man in the room. Yep. And that he can talk his way in and out of anything. And so, you know, he gets contacted by Andrew Jarecki, the director of the HBO series The Jinx, who is doing this documentary on the death of Susan Berman. And basically Jarecki says, hey, I'd love to interview you. I'd love to get your side of the story. I'd love to hear, you know, your thoughts on what happened. And literally every single person that Robert Durst interacts with says, this is a terrible idea. You should not do this. And Robert Durst knows best. You know, I've watched The Jinx. It is lengthy, in-depth interviews of Durst just making, you know, statement after statement after statement that at his trial all became contradicted. I mean, his positions, like, it just came out that these were lies and these were lies and these were lies. And so as the jury is getting exposed to the statements that he made in The Jinx, and then hearing what's coming out at trial, I mean, he is just digging a deeper and deeper and deeper hole. And I want to go back to the interview that Durst gave in New Orleans after he's arrested. So he's arrested the last day, or the day that the final episode of The Jinx airs on HBO. The FBI picks him up that day, and John Lewin immediately flies out with an investigator to New Orleans to try and interview him. Now, Durst has been arrested, so he is under no obligation to speak to law enforcement. He can invoke his right to silence. He can just say, I want a lawyer. I don't want to speak. And that's it. The interview is over. That is an absolute right that a criminal defendant has in the system in America. Durst doesn't do that. Durst waives his right to have a lawyer there and sits with Lewin and the investigator for 3 hours, where an unbelievably overprepared John Lewin cross-examines him on everything Susan Berman related he can get in. From your perspective, how damaging was this interview as it unfolded during the trial?
Oh, it was incredibly damaging because it was brought up later in trial. There are contradictory statements in there to what he actually, you know, implied, like you said, in The Jinx. And then you've got him actually, this is the real world. You know, you're sitting across the table from a prosecutor. And I guess, you know, I equate it to people that get pulled over by cops. And they think that they're going to argue their way out of something. Crossing swords, if you, and cops cross swords for that's their profession. Mm-hmm. It's verbal judo, is they actually have classes in this. And so if you take that same template and you apply it to this conversation, this interview, and at this point, it's I guess you could frame it as an interrogation. He's waived his right at this point to counsel.
Sure.
Now he's going to cross swords with a prosecutor from a major city who does this for a living. All the while, it's like a fly on flypaper. No matter how much you, the more you struggle, the more adherent your body becomes. And for him, in this particular circumstance, that is, in fact, what happened. And, you know, I guess at the end of the day, for him, it was one of the most damning events that occurred. But it goes to this narcissistic element, you know, where you think that, you know, you're going to defeat everybody you come in contact with. But, you know, there was a bigger theme here, I think, because this is an L.A. County case. You know, HBO has a headquarters there. They're producing movies out there. And essentially, maybe if it had happened anywhere else, maybe it hadn't, it would not have come off this way. But the DA had a black eye in this case, because literally you've got this case, this high profile guy. He's getting, the show is getting tremendous ratings. And he's essentially, Durst, that is, metaphorically sticking his thumb in their eye. That's why this prosecutor went back in time. Now, do I agree with it? No, I don't agree with it. But he zeroed in on Durst, and he was rolling the dice. And I think that he probably knew Durst better than I think Durst thought that he might know him. This is not Westchester County in 1982.
Yeah,
there's histrionics going on here now. His whole life has played out now on this timeline. Everybody's been there to see it. All the articles that have been written over the years, all the teleplays that have been created. And finally, the DA has just had all they can stand, because there's no telling what kind of political pressure was being placed upon them, that they've got to do something right now, or this is going to stink to high heaven for years and years and years to come. I think my question is that at the end of the day, is it going to stand? And will Durst actually survive? Because he's this frail little old guy now. Is he actually going to survive where he's going to pay the price, which now the people of LA County and California have stated, you owe us something. You owe us the rest of your life behind bars. Is he actually going to be able to, you know, he very well might, you know, metaphorically, again, cheat the hangman with this. Because I don't know that his health would hold.
I think I saw in this morning that the headlines were that he's back in the intensive care unit. So
yeah, and I don't doubt it. I mean, he was, you know, and I don't, the physical manifestation that kind of, in medical terminology, they refer to it as the dwindles. You begin to see people that are, you know, declining greatly. And isn't that fascinating, Paul? We actually saw this man in, I don't know if I'd use the word tragic, but you're sitting there and you're watching him dwindle before your very eyes over the years. You go back and you look at the end to the filming of the Jinx, and he was a bit more robust, had great color and all those sorts of things. Now he's sitting there and he's got this shunt in his head, you know, and the camera was always on it. It was, I think it's the right aspect of his head, and it was there. You know, you could see the back of his head there the entire time. And, you know, they're talking about changing bladder bags, and all these, and he's coughing and he's hacking, but every now and then he would spin his head around and he would look and he would engage visually with these people in court, and he would glare as well. He would lean forward, he would look to his right over at counsel sitting at the other table, and he would glare at these people. Mm-hmm. And the entire time, you know, he's got this electronic, you know, thing,
tablet.
And he's taking notes feverishly, or, you know, researching things. He's engaged on one level, but, you know, I just don't know how much more he can take at this
point. Yeah. And look, to go to that point, I think during the trial, I think he was energized because of the fight. I mean, let's not forget, Robert Durst was on the stand for cross-examination for 9 days.
Yep.
That is an unbelievably physically and emotionally taxing thing for a healthy, robust, middle-aged person to do.
Yes, it is.
And this was not a slouch of a cross-examination. This was, quite frankly, one of the most prepared, organized cross-examinations that I have ever seen. And look, there's a lot that I did not like about John Lewin's conduct in this case. But I don't think anybody can take away from the fact that John Lewin has an encyclopedic knowledge of Robert Durst's entire life. He was, during cross-examination, off the top of his head, citing to transcripts from the Morris Black case, from his own interview with him, from other depositions that Durst had taken, from the documentary. Literally anything that Robert Durst has ever said, John Lewin could recall with perfect clarity. It was impressive to watch. And I think that this goes back again, you know, Durst taking the stand, believing that he was going to talk his way out of it, that he was going to cross swords with John Lewin, and that he was going to be the victor. I think both sides knew deep down that they were going to meet on that stage. Durst knew he was going to testify. There was never a question in his mind. Lewin knew that Durst was going to testify. There was never a question in his mind. And Lewin did the work to be as prepared as humanly possible to ask him every single question, literally under the sun. I mean, half of it was completely irrelevant in my legal opinion, but he had a methodology that was really fascinating to watch, as it really just pinpointed literally every single inconsistency that Robert Durst has had in his life for 40 years. And so with that, I want to take you to your overall opinion and impression of John Lewin as he walked through this case. He is clearly a person who it's not too difficult to get under his skin. He's an agitatable person.
Right.
So I want to hear, you know, your watching him in action, kind of your perceptions and whether or not you found his presentation compelling, the way that he presented the case. What was the good? What was the bad? What was the ugly of John Lewin?
I think the good, the upside with him was, in fact, like you stated, Paul, very effectively, that he was uber prepared. You ever run across that kid where they just seem like they knew every little point along the continuum about everything? Mm-hmm. That's John Lewin when it comes to Robert Durst. And he knew every, as they say, every jot and tittle of Durst's life, backwards and forwards. I think that it would be doing John Lewin a disservice to say he was overprepared, because when you're talking about a personality like Robert Durst, you have to be overprepared, because this guy he is so uber focused on the fight, and you better come prepared. And John Lewin did. He did. And I think that again is a double-edged sword when you begin to think about the presentation, because you had stated under his skin. You know, probably DeGuerin is one of the most affable people. You know, when he comes off with that good old Southern boy Texas drawl, you know, howdy ma'am, how are y'all today? Good to see y'all, that sort of thing. And easy to get along with. And he never came off as a bad guy, but if Lewin, he's so exacting, he's almost like a clockmaker, if you will, that if any little spindle or gear got out of line in this thing that he had constructed, he was going to take exception to it. And that came across. And I was really amazed at how much, again, here we are back to this term, how much latitude the judge gave to John Lewin with some of these protestations in court, and his reaction is very animated and demonstrative about things. And also where there was a source of irritation on the part of the judge at one point in time, if I remember correctly, Lewin is sitting in a chair, and I'll never forget this. He's sitting in a chair, you see his back, and which is kind of an odd position to be in. And he's speaking to somebody, and there's an ADA or somebody that keeps walking forward and handing him things in court. And one of the witnesses was in mid-sentence. He had asked him a very direct, she or he, I can't remember, asked him a very direct question about very specific information. And as this person is speaking, Lewin looks down at the paper, and he's not paying any attention to what this person is saying. And the judge called that into question at one point in time, if I remember correctly, because it was, you know, it's just kind of disrespectful. But I think that goes to his worldview and the way he saw this. You know, he's kind of like he was almost surgical with this, and he knew the landscape so well that he could take his eyes off just for a moment. And he's probably still hearing it and processing it. And he's trying to do 5 and 6 moves ahead the entire time. It was a Herculean task, I think, for anybody. But I, at the end of the day, when this thing gets up to the appellate level, kudos for being really well prepared. But at the end of the day, if the thing does get overturned on any of these points that you've so accurately mentioned, was it all worth it at the end of the day? Because now you're sending a little old frail man to prison, and I don't know how long it'll last. And what have you accomplished at the end of the day?
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I also have, you know, pieces of activity by John Lewin that stick with me. I remember specifically when Durst himself was on the stand, and Lewin is just peppering him. Mm-hmm. And he asks him this very complicated, long question. And Durst has all of the trial on transcript that appears on this tablet in front of him, because he's a little bit hard of hearing now because of his ailments. And so he's looking, and it's comical watching him read this like 6-line question that comes mm-hmm. through. And he basically just looks up and he tells John Lewin that he has just set the record for longest question, you know, that he's ever been asked. And Lewin, without even thinking, just shoots back, "Well, you've set the record for perjury in a trial." Yep. Yep. And that was remarkably inappropriate. I mean, it was something that a prosecutor should absolutely never do, because now you're signaling that you are making this case personal. It's not about the case anymore. It's about you. It's about your ego. It's about your need to win. It's not about justice. And that to me is who John Lewin is, or at least is during this trial. That I had such a problem with that attitude. And there were several other times where he would just let these, you know, zippy one-liners fly out, and they were so inappropriate. And most of the time they were done outside the presence of the jury, but not all the time. And I really took exception to how the judge handled it, because he really just kind of was like, "All right, you know, Mr. Lewin, that's quite enough," you know, and really never kind of had that, you know, back in chambers right now, everybody, you know, that I would have expected, where he would have really laid it down and said, "You know, Mr. Lewin, you are being wildly inappropriate, you know, especially in front of the jury. You know, you need to get your bearings. You need to calm down, you know, take a minute and conduct yourself professionally in my courtroom." And that just was never done.
And I think I'm kind of an old school guy. There were a couple of moments. I just had a memory sitting here. There was a judge in New Orleans who this guy's watchword was decorum at every level, you know, suit, tie, the whole night. You're going to show up here. You're going to do what I say. This is my courtroom. I know attorneys specifically that were held in contempt because they kept crossing that line, and this guy would snap them back into place. And, you know, Lewin so many times did this, and, you know, it's kind of like this judge is kind of like the parent with an unruly child, you know, that always threatens something or always says something, but never acts on it.
There's no,
you know, bite. And yeah, there's no bite to it. There's nothing to fear here. He knows he's not going to be held in contempt, or it's analogous maybe to that sort of thing, because, you know, the judge, I'm terrified of judges. I've always been terrified of judges. I don't view them as my friend or colleague. I understand my position as a witness relative to them. I'm very respectful, but that's just kind of how I've always been. Lawyers are different because you guys work with them all the time. Going in as a witness, though, I understand that I'm coming before the holy throne, if you will, you know, when you walk in there, and I'm terrified. That yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, you know, and very succinct with my answers, and I always play nice. And he felt really, really, how can I say, very comfortable, maybe overly comfortable.
Far too comfortable.
Yeah.
All right. So my last question, and then we'll wrap up, is the defense team, DeGaron and Chesanoff. You know, for me, watching this trial, it became frustrating as a defense attorney, because there were so many instances where Lewin would ask a question or something would be admitted into evidence. And I'm sitting and I'm watching and the defense team is just sitting there. And I'm just saying, why are you objecting? This is really inappropriate. You know, this is hearsay. You know, this is propensity evidence. This is inadmissible. I would be on my feet jumping up and down. Judge, absolutely not. Objection, objection, objection. Yep. This is outrageous. And the entire trial, I felt like I just watched the defense team kind of sit there and let things go in. There were a number of stipulations that the defense team entered into. And at one point, Bob Thirst is on the stand and he's, you know, he answers a question. And basically Lewin says, are you aware that your lawyers have stipulated to something contradictory to that? And his response was basically like, I would never have stipulated to it. You know, so the defense team, I think, really gave away probably a bit too much in the stipulations. And there's always rulings and back and forth, you know, in pretrial hearings and pretrial filings that kind of go to the scope of what's able to be admitted and not. And so I would imagine some of these things were already adjudicated. And so DeGaron and Chesanoff knew that they, you know, an objection would be fruitless. But, you know, for my mind, you know, I'm at trial, I'm always thinking, you know, I have to preserve the record. I have to make
you
sure
got it. You got to get it on the record. You have to do it and you have to do it vigorously. Yeah, I think in their case, and you were right in saying it seemed as though, I'll use this word again, or the root, that the vigor was absent many times. It almost seemed to me, and maybe this is my own perception or I'm making this up, I think that there was this air of frustration because there was so much stuff allowed in this. It's almost like it was written in stereo instructions in a dead language. There were so many possibilities and that they had to account for in this thing. And how are you going to fight? Because it is a fight. I always view you guys as warriors in the courtroom. It is a fight, man. It's absolutely why it's called defense. It's a fight. And it's hard enough to fight it on one front. But when you think about the position they're being placed in, Kathy Durst, we're talking about, I always refer to him as poor old Morris Black, you know, sawed to pieces and cut to pieces and thrown in Galveston Bay. And of course, the person that got mentioned the least is Susan. She did not get much time on the stage. And again, that was something that was absolutely striking to me. You know, if you could tally that up, I think on put it on some kind of matrices and you could actually see it. It would be striking as to how much time she was given, or that person that the trial is about, compared to these other things and girlfriends and all
issues.
Yeah.
Well, as we know, Robert Durst was convicted by the jury of the murder of Susan Berman. He was recently sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. I have no doubts that an appeal will be forthcoming. And you know, I really look forward to reading that, because I think there's so much of this trial that could play into an appeal. So, you know, Joseph Scott Morgan, thank you so much for coming on. If people wanted to find you, follow you, listen to you, where can they find you?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm on Twitter, Medco Legal Death, MedcoLegalDeath, Medco Legal Death. It's just Joseph Scott Morgan. I'm on Instagram and all that sort of thing. And I have my own podcast that launched a few weeks back called Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan. It's doing quite well. Very proud of it. And it's on iHeart and Spotify and Apple and all these different platforms and whatnot. And it's purely forensics. I put it out once a week. I don't get into a lot of extraneous issues and you know, I just stick to the science. I try to and break down some of the cases of the day and talk about the forensics behind them. And then I urge everybody that's interested in a forensic science program for your child or grandchild, please look at my university, Jacksonville State University in Jacksonville, Alabama. We have a major in forensic investigations, and it's a fantastic program. One of the oldest in the South, been around since about 1974. So we predate all of the Hollywood presentations and that sort of thing. We've been doing this for a long, long time. So, but Paul, thank you so much for this opportunity to chat with you. And I really appreciate it. And thank you to your audience.
Oh, thanks. This was great. I really appreciate it. We'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much.
Very good. All right, Paul. Thanks.
So that's the show, this installment on Robert Durst. Special thank you to Joseph Scott Morgan for coming on to discuss the case with me. And a special thank you to Dan Townsend, my audio engineer. If you enjoy the show, I encourage you to subscribe and check out all the other episodes. If you have feedback, you can reach me through the show's website, insummation.com. You can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Again, I do want to thank everybody who has reached out to me regarding the show. It really does mean a lot that you guys are engaged and curious about these particular legal issues, just like I am. Until next time, thank you so much for stopping by, and I hope that you will come back for more.